Welcome to the Baseball America Podcast. Baseball America, bringing you baseball news you can't get anywhere else for more than 35 years. Now it's time to talk baseball.
Hey, welcome everyone to another Baseball America Playoff Podcast. We like doing these daily. People seem to like it as well. We appreciate all the downloads on iTunes. Feel free to review us and rate us on the iTunes app or however you digest this podcast. I'm John Manuel, along with J.J. Cooper and Kyle Glazer this morning. Game one of the World Series in the books, guys. 6-0 victory for the Cleveland Indians. And, you know, JJ, we've done these podcasts pretty much every day. And we talked about how, I can't remember if it was this podcast or another one I did here locally. But it does seem like Corey Kluber was, if you're looking for best kept secrets in baseball, he's one of them just because of how good he's been winning a Cy Young Award 2 years ago, but being a Cleveland Indian and not being a prominent team nationally, you're not going to have much more of a coming out party than last night, where there was actual, I think, debate and should have been doubt about whether or not they should have taken him out for Andrew Miller, which has been an automatic move. But Corey Kluber was so good last night, and it seems like he was at his best in the first couple of innings.
Right. I do think that part of that decision to pull him, I wonder how much of that is well, you're going 1-4-7, so let's give you a little bit extra rest because we expect to see you back very soon. But no, it is something where I don't feel too much for Cleveland fans because they're out in force now, but they weren't out in force exactly during the year. But it is kind of true. It's like Corey Kluber being a secret is, this is a Cy Young winner. Like I saw, right, a lot of tweets yesterday. It's like Francisco Lindor, this is his chance to become a star. It's like, he's not playing at a different level of Francisco Lindor. This is Francisco Lindor. He's a great shortstop who can hit. I mean, that's a great combo.
But it is, bottom line, is that baseball is not great at creating or promoting stars. I don't think the average fan who just tunes in the World Series knows who any of these guys are. And they definitely don't know Corey Kluber. And they sure as hell don't know that Corey Kluber has this highest spin rate in major leagues for his breaking ball. And it's, I think he's known and has been known for a while for his ability to get swings and misses with a breaking ball, Kyle. But his fastball last night was just ridiculous.
You know, watching his two-seam fastball, I mean, it's always a good pitch. That's a pitch that he's, you know, thrown well for years now and really helped him become one of the best pitchers in baseball along with his other stuff. But the way he was locating it last night, the movement on it, how he was dotting every quadrant of the inner half of the zone against left-handers, you know, it actually made me think, we're sitting here doing our prospect grades, oh, is X a 60 pitch, is X a 70 pitch? The way that was playing last night, is that not an 80 pitch?
That's an 80.
Exactly.
You cannot hit it, period.
And it doesn't have to be 100 miles an hour. Now, that's, we've talked about that for a long time. It's always good to restate. There's more than one component to rating a fastball. And, you know, it's, I do get frustrated sometimes by, I shouldn't, but it's not just velocity. When we rank best tools and we talk about best fastball, even in a draft class, there's so many ways to grade a fastball. Life, command, when the life happens. Is it early or late? And then there's also velocity, and there's this effective velocity. I mean, there's so many aspects to it. Corey Kluber pretty much had everything last night because he commanded a fastball with plus velocity, but it was 80 command. He put it wherever he wanted to, JJ, and the life was always late and always seemed to be where he wanted it.
And that's the thing is that the command with that life. Because there's a...
But it's also 94. He wasn't throwing 88.
Right. But it doesn't have to be Aroldis Chapman.
But right, that command with that life, because it is hard to command a fastball with that much life. It was interesting. I mean, that was a very, very, very left-handed lineup that he was facing. Which, if you're saying, how are you going to attack Corey Kluber, that's a good way to do it because it doesn't take his slider away, but it does diminish it somewhat because, you know, if you're a right-handed hitter, that slider is much more devastating than if you're a left-handed hitter. Going against lefty after lefty after lefty, he didn't need a slider because if you're a lefty, I mean, we often talk about how having a changeup can be that equalizer against a, you know,
I
basically
think traditionally it is. I mean, how many really good two-seamers do you see in today's game?
But when you have a changeup, the reason a lot of times that it is effective when you are going against a guy who you don't have a platoon advantage is because a really good changeup has that late tail. He was doing that at 94 miles an hour. I mean, it doesn't have the fade as much, but it did have, He could start over and over in on the hands and then tick the on the inside corner of the strike zone. That is essentially an unhittable pitch.
Two seamers and cutters away from the barrel all night. And that's the thing, is that he has just the ability. When you read a scouting report, or you talk to a scout, and they talk about the ability to manipulate the fastball. That was what we saw last night. And the great thing about it for me is during the day, you see on social media that it was 45th birthday for Pedro Martinez, number 45. And you see a lot of Pedro highlights on social media.
Speaking of manipulating the barrel.
And that's what I'm saying. That is, he was the ultimate pitcher at manipulating a baseball and putting the ball where the hitter didn't want it to be. And that's what we kind of saw from Corey Kluber last night. He, completely different body, different kind of pitcher, but it was the same effect. And to see someone manipulate the baseball at a high velocity like that, it was artwork the first time through. Kyle, did you have any? Did you second guess Terry Francona at all for bringing in Andrew Miller when he did?
My first thought was they're pulling him at 88 pitches with how good he's been. My initial response is this seems a little premature. But again, when it's Andrew Miller you're turning it over to, even though it got a little dicey, I mean, it's a little more defensible. If this was a case of, you know, say the Dodgers, and they literally have one guy in their bullpen you trust, and you're doing that, maybe I don't like the move if they have their star doing that. If it's, you know, the Red Sox even, with, you know, some of the bullpen issues they had late in the year at various points, I don't know if you do that. But when you have, when you can still go starter, Miller, Allen, and just be done with it, I'm okay with it.
The other thing about it is Miller coming in against that very left-handed lineup. Obviously, they did bring in some, you know, Castillo came in and pinched. They did bring in right-handers later, but it did mean they still had multiple guys Miller was facing in key situations where he had the platoon advantage, which...
It didn't seem like it bothered Kyle Schwarber. No. He took very comfortable swings. And that was, to me, that was the highlight of the game, was these two Miller-Schwarber matchups. Because Andrew Miller comes in, and he's using that situation not because he's their middle reliever and Cody Allen's their closer. It's because you're facing Schwarber. And I just think it's amazing that Kyle Schwarber, I think everyone recognizes how amazing what we saw last night was, that second at bat where he just missed the home run off the top of the wall. To be that comfortable and that confident in the box when you've basically not faced big league pitching for as long as he had. And a couple warm-ups in the Arizona Fall League, and hey, let's go.
Right, and it was two games. It wasn't like he played a week's worth of games in the
right.
fall. Two games.
Yeah. I know he'd been working out with the Cubs and taking live BP, but it's not
different.
The same.
It's different.
So come in and face Kluber and Andrew Miller and look as comfortable in the box and take as confident of swings as he did. That's a special, special hitter who it's just really rare to see someone who's that balanced, that strong, and at the same time has those kind of hands. He's such a gorgeous offensive approach to watch. And the walk that he took, I tell you, I've been able to see Andrew Miller up close and from a distance for more than 10 years now. And he was as into that game emotionally, the displays of emotion that you don't see. And he couldn't believe that Kyle Schwarber laid off that 3-2 slider.
That was
he could
amazing.
Not believe it. It was like, who the hell is this guy taking that slider? That was a nasty pitch. And for Schwarber, that was an amazing take. And then for Miller to still, seeing him a second time, get him out on that 3-2 nasty slider where Schwarber did not get cheated on that swing. Was it 2-2 or 3-2? I forget the count now. I think it was 2-2. But that was just, those two matchups were to me the essence of the game. The batter-pitcher matchup and two guys at an extremely high level going at it. That was baseball poetry.
I'll throw one other at-bat Miller, you know, versus batter that was similar because David Ross, who is obviously not as accomplished a hitter as Schwarber, but David Ross got ahead where I thought that the announcers did a good job last night. I think it was Smoltz.
John Smoltz was fantastic.
Smoltz basically said, here you are, you're in a 3-1 count if I remember right. It's like, you just basically go up there and you're looking fastball, and if he throws a slider and he throws it for a strike,
so be it.
You know, if you see slider, you just take.
Right.
And that's exactly what Ross did. And the thing about it is that what you saw, I mean, in the game theory that is going on with this, if you're David Ross, Andrew Miller threw that slider, he threw it for a strike, and then you're 3-2, and it's like, you are completely screwed.
That's right.
Because he showed on 3-1 that he could throw that pitch, then you're sitting here at 3-2, and you have to protect everything. And you can't protect everything against Andrew Miller. It literally was because it was a key situation.
You've only got two, but they're both so good. You can't. It's so impossible to adjust. You know?
The thing that, again, I came away from this game thinking about is, you know, obviously having the pitch mix and being able to have a well-rounded ability to, you know, spot the ball where you want it. But when you have that one pitch, I mean, we talk about Kluber's two-seamer last night was an 80 pitch.
Yeah.
Miller's slider is an 80 pitch.
Oh, yeah.
You can't. So when you have the, you know, each guy with that one pitch that you cannot hit. Major leaguer, accomplished, rookie, doesn't matter. You are not going to hit this, and if you do, you sure as heck aren't going to square it up.
That's
such a powerful weapon to have and so rare.
And they made him work. They made him work despite those two. I thought both pitches were on last night. I thought it was a tribute to the Cubs. They really made him work last night. It was 46 pitches.
And even with that, they still got shut out with six hits. So it's something where it's like they made him. I mean, that's how powerful those are. So that's where, you know, my takeaway from it was, if you have that, and we talk how rare an 80 anything is, if you have that pitch that can just make major league hitters look helpless, no matter what else you throw, that put away pitch, beyond put away pitch, that elevates you to another level.
Well, the other thing about it is when we talked about the arm side run it has, this is one of the things, and one of the things I wanted to talk about today was this kind of the progression of Corey Kluber. I actually printed out our scouting reports from when he was in the draft, when he was with the Padres, when he was with the Indians, and then John's IL report when he was the last year was prospect eligible. He wasn't even prospect eligible after the season, but really the only year we have a report after the transformation has started. But one of the points with that is because Kluber did not throw that two-seamer until very late in his minor league career. They did a good job last night of explaining Mickey Callaway and how he developed and all that. But if you don't have that command and you're throwing that two-seamer, you talked about the barrel manipulation. That's a very dangerous pitch to throw.
If it gets too far over the plate,
If you aren't starting that in on the hands where it ticks the inside corner where you're front-dooring guys, if you start that on the inside half of the plate, it's going to end up right on the barrel.
That's why that pitch is a tough pitch, and that's why there's certain pitching coaches who don't like teaching that pitch. They think it's an injury risk, A, or they think it's a ball that if you miss, if you're a right-handed pitcher, and you think about it, a two-seamer is basically, there's a little pronation. It's supposed to be, it's kind of like a half screwball. But if you're trying to get in, say you're trying to throw that Greg Maddux pitch, that fastball at the hip that backs up over the inside corner, but you instead release it at the inside corner, backs up over the middle of the plate,
right.
You're finding the barrel and you're getting squared up for home runs.
You have basically, if you're throwing that pitch, you have two choices with it. It has to either start in off the plate,
right?
Or you can go away with it where at the worst case, if you miss it a little bit where you started over the middle of the plate, it ends up on the edge,
right?
Or it starts off on the edge of the outside corner, basically the arm side corner, and it is up off the plate,
right?
Because that's at least a ball.
Exactly.
Okay, that's fine. No one's tagging a fastball with a two-seamer with run that ends up off the out plate out the outside. Very few players are, I should say. But the thing about it is that this is where, and I wanted to throw out for both you guys, and when we're doing this, we're right now in the middle of prospect season, and this is the thing that always is so tough with pitchers. I don't think that is nearly as tough with hitters, because Corey Kluber, if you are, you know, I saw, he's getting mentioned, you know, like, oh, you know, people, like the freezing cold tricks, you know, brings out this over and over about this tweet of, you know, a scout. Been when the Padres traded Kluber, saying, hey, that's a number five starter. You know, that's a great trade for the Padres. And obviously, that ended up not being true. Great pickup for the Indians. But this is really more of a development story than it is like a scouting story, because how do you can't project Corey Kluber to turn into Cy Young winner at age 28 when he basically has given you this 5 years of track record where he had a 2011 AAA, 7-11, 5.56, 153 hits in 152 innings, 4.1 walks per nine, 8.5 Ks per nine. There's no logical progression.
And that wasn't in the PCL either. That wasn't the international.
No logical progression from there to ace.
I think it goes back to when a guy is in your own system, you have to know your guys better than anyone else, and you know, we've talked a lot, and I know Padres fans kicking when they're down, but one of the things that I saw a lot, and admittedly this was before I was covering the team, but the Padres under Kevin Towers had an incredible pro scouting department and a horrendous amateur scouting department. And then in the years after that, with, you know, a mix of Hoyer, Burns, or the pro scouting department, with the rare, you know, the hit on Tyson Ross, the hit on Ian Kennedy, but there were so many horrendous moves at the pro scouting level where they just did not properly identify who they even had in their own system. And I think some of that was just the fact that, you know, there was so much turmoil and turnover with the ownership at the time and the new general managers coming in and new scouts and new farm directors. But at the same time, you know, how do you have that guy in your system for as many years as you do and not think, you know, he's got an ability to spin the ball a little bit. Let's mess with a two-seamer. And I think some of that was just, you know, we talk about, oh, you have to draft well. But one of the things I've talked about is you can draft the best studs in the world. No guy who's a great 18-year-old is going to be ready to hit major league pitching when they're 24, 25 automatically. You have to develop them. You have to teach them how to do certain things in the box, how to throw more pitches, how to get that consistent delivery. And when you see something, you have to know these guys. When they're your guys, in and out.
That's
and
the biggest
mistake.
And if you don't,
know them, you are not doing your job.
That is the biggest mistake of an organization when they don't know their own talent. I mean, we always talked about the Braves with that 14-year stretch. They just so rarely, the pitchers they gave up on were the Pete Smiths. Like Jason Schmidt was probably the best big league pitcher they traded. Yeah, but otherwise, they generally traded guys, whether it was Melvin Nieves or Ben Rivera.
Right. They got
who
Fred
else?
McGriff for Jack Squat. That's
right.
Impressive.
It was a long stretch.
Who was
where
the 100-mile-an-hour guy back when 100 miles?
Jose Capion.
Jose Capion.
Yeah.
Like, hey.
They generally were very good at identifying which prospects had hype that weren't worth keeping and which ones were. And that's a key for all organizations. I do think you hit on it with the Padres. I'm not trying to criticize the scouts or even the front office, but a lot of times, and you see it, whether it was even with the A.J. Preller regime, and those new guys who came in and said, Trey Turner's not our guy. They weren't wedded to Trey Turner, and they kind of gave him away. You know, kudos to the Nationals for identifying him and Joe Ross in that three-team trade. So
heist.
That's a heist. That's one of the could be an all-time heist. So it definitely happens, I think, with all organizations. When there is turnover, that the new regime doesn't value or properly evaluate a lot of times the players for the old regime.
It's funny, and again, this is just a random aside, but bringing back to Schwarber, you know, it is something where it is difficult. There, I've seen Cubs fans, and this is just fans, but this is Twitter. But you know, well, I'm okay with Schwarber being, you know, because he's not good defensively, and we, you know, he doesn't fit with what we're doing defensively. And all it's like, no, that's when you have a guy who has that rare kind of hit plus power. That is,
you get him in
the on the hitter side. That's the hardest thing to find.
Yeah, that's about as an elite of a bat as you can find. I mean, so he was number four in the Florida State League in 2014, the year he was drafted, number four prospect, behind Tyler Glasnow, J.P. Crawford, Daniel Norris. In some ways, I wish I had that one to do over again. But I always remember, you know, everybody was mixed on his defense. But I remember Dave Keller, his manager at Daytona, those 2 years. He had Chris Bryant the year before. He had Kyle Schwarber the next year. And as much as he loved Bryant and as good of a debut as Bryant had, he signed in 2013, was FSL playoff MVP, then he was the Arizona Fall League MVP, and you know,
rookie
was rookie of the year the next year.
And probably the MVP this year.
The guy he just didn't do anything wrong, but he was like, hey, Bryant's a better athlete. He's probably got more power than Kyle Schwarber. But Kyle Schwarber's the best young hitter I've seen in years and years. And Dave and I went back to when he was the hitting coach in Hickory in the White Sox organization in 1995, and I covered him. He had Carlos Lee on that team. Some other guys who got to the big leagues, like
was
Mark Johnson.
Was Magno Ordóñez?
That was the year before, 1994, but good call.
Very underrated player for
his
era.
And he was
fantastic.
A hell of a hitter. Hell of a hitter.
Fantastic.
So Dave had been around a lot of great hitters, and Schwarber was in a class of his own just for pure hitting ability. And so he's
And this is what we talked about on the podcast Monday, is like when you have pure hitters like that, you don't need a month to get ready.
That's right, and that's also knowing your own players. The Cubs knew what they had in Kyle Schwarber, and even hurt. You had these stories. I saw Mike Berardino tweet this yesterday about the Yankees. The Cubs tried to trade for Andrew Miller. The Yankees insisted on Kyle Schwarber being in the deal, and the Cubs said no and moved on to Chapman.
The Royals said Wade Davis for Schwarber. That was the other.
I just would be terrified to see Kyle Schwarber play that ballpark. If Brian McCann, and I'll respect the Brian McCann, but if the shell of Brian McCann could still hit 20 home runs a year playing in Yankee Stadium.
Well, Kyle Schwarber would be a 50 home run threat with that short porch.
I think that he would be Ruthian. I think that he would hit 60 home runs. So two things, a couple of tweets I wanted to point out from last night also. Elliot Johnson, former big league infielder, played with the Indians. I think it was his last team. He had a couple tweets last night that really made me sit up and take notice. One where he was talking about Kluber's two-seamer, and he just tweeted out after one pitch, down the middle, Joe, talking about Joe Buck, who actually, for Joe Buck standards, I thought had a good night last night, because he's pretty good at setting up Smoltz, and it's his first World Series game working with John Smoltz. He's had one other series to build some chemistry. I think Smoltz is an easy guy to set up. He's so stinking good.
Smoltz and A-Rod are the stars of
football. They really are, TV-wise. But down the middle, Joe, that's a heavy 93-mile-an-hour backdoor two-seamer with heavy late action catching the black. I love hearing a guy who had to hit against that kind of stuff describe it. And then his next tweet, like about an hour later, about Kluber was, I honestly haven't seen that type of two-seam movement on the glove side since Josh Beckett back in the day. That was not who I expected him to bring that up to. But
interesting.
But yeah, Josh Beckett. And then he talked about Andrew Miller. 3-1 slider with the bags pack. No big deal. I mean, that is game respect game. I'm not sure how much. I'm giving Ellie a lot of credit. But still, hey, it takes a big leaguer, I think, sometimes to recognize that. Where we talk about, like I think it's cool, having done games myself on TV, I think it's cool that I get to do college baseball games on TV or minor league baseball games on TV. But when I've worked with, like, just here locally, Scott Pose with the Durham Bulls or Paul Shuey on some of these Carolina baseball games I did, to have the insight.
All-time mustache.
He did. But when Zach Birdie this year was throwing 100 miles an hour for Louisville, and I just was able to do that game with Paul and just go, so, Paul, you throw 100 miles an hour on this field. What's that feeling like? And he goes, oh, he knew he threw 100 because he was looking over his shoulder at the radar gun, and he didn't look when it was 98 or below. He knew. And I noticed after Paul, or instantly noticed. So there is something about, I know that we as writers like to, a lot of baseball fans like to bash sometimes players who are analysts, and sometimes it can be shallow, or when I played this and that, but sometimes they really do bring incredible insight. I think Smoltz is at the top of that list.
No, because again, extremely insightful. The thing that what you want from an analyst, and I don't think that every player can do this, and that's partly why there are good ones and bad ones at it, but what you want is the person who understands the batter-pitcher battle, because that's 90% of the time what you're going to be talking about.
Yeah.
And understands it well enough to have the confidence to say, so here's what you're going to look for here, and here's what's going to happen next.
Right, right.
And the guys who can do that.
And the thing is, to me, Smoltz, for some reason, maybe it was just that he never makes a Broadway reference while doing it. He does it in a so much more enjoyable way than McCarver ever did for me. I just always felt I was being preached to by McCarver. Well, I feel like Smoltz is talking with me. And it's a difference, I don't know what the difference is. But Tim McCarver always bugged the snot out of me with that.
Another tweet from last night was pretty good. Is that, you know, we had the moment where Santana cramps up, and so they have to stop the game to basically pump him full of fluids and all, which. And Smoltz is talking about how, as a pitcher, you have to just accept this. There's nothing you can do about it. All that, and Jeff Schultz with the AJC who covered Smoltz there, and he's like, Come on. You would have gone crazy if that happened when you were on the mound.
I thought Lester kind of handled it actually better than I expected him to, because he's got that ornery side. I like this other tweet that Brandon McCarthy wrote when he was talking about the Yips.
Best tweeter right now in Major League Baseball for my money.
I think it's Dan Heron. Even if he's retired, Dan Heron's better.
Active players, Brandon McCarthy.
He's sort of active.
Hey, he's on a 60-day DL, and he's getting paid as an active player.
I love Brandon, but once you go through the Yips, it totally changes how you watch Lester. The fact he's still this good is astounding, and that is up. I thought that he was good last night, but we knew, JJ, that what they did, that what the Indians' ability to actually make something of their running game, not just threaten it and tease it like the Dodgers, that it would be more effective, and it seemed like it was in the first inning.
It was, although the thing about it is it's still crazy, because Lindor did get thrown out the second time
except he didn't throw. He got thrown out, except he didn't throw it.
He got thrown out.
Yeah. The stolen base. That was another
incredible hashtag Javi tag. I don't even know if he got him or not.
I don't think he did, but I also understand why he didn't challenge him.
It's just amazing.
By the way, Ross popped up, gone. That was a great throw by him.
Yeah.
But the thing about it is that was a 50 throw. It was a two, like they the stacked.
Timing, quick
2.0 throw.
Quick time to the plate by
Quick time to the plate.
He's always quick to the plate.
Quick release.
Quick to the plate. But the thing that you do come back is that John Lester's throwing inability to throw, players still cannot process it. And what I mean by that is
because Lindor did not get a good jump.
Lindor Statcast now can do this, so Statcast spit it out afterwards. You know, so I think he was at 24 feet when he went, and like the average lead secondary lead is 23.
Right.
again, you do this all year, and even if you've already just seen that literally you went halfway to the bag, he steps off and he's like, I'm not throwing. Even after you see that, you're still not capable of really believing that, you know what, I can go 28 feet here.
Well, it's because it's something you've been doing since you were 12, 13 mm-hmm. years old, where you learn, okay, this is how far I get, this is my secondary leak, here's what I look for and get back. It's ingrained.
You can't get it out of your head. He can, you know, understandably in some ways, but you can't get out of your head.
Yeah.
No, I'm okay here.
He's played close to 700 games as a professional. And none of those games has Francisco Lindor ever thought to myself, I'm going to get 30 feet out from the bag. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go where I normally go and then go one-third or 25% more.
And truthfully, base running is so instinctual. I mean, right. It's such a program. If you're thinking, you're done.
One thing I will disagree, because like having had, the funny thing is Mike Roberts, who to me knows more about, like this is what Mike Roberts does. I'm going to say, he's one of the, to me.
He's very expert in this. I'm sure there are others that we haven't spoken to.
He's literally written the book.
Yes, but he's written a book. I think the Colton Wong didn't get the memo.
Right.
Colton Wong learned it wrong.
Colton Wong basically ruined the idea of anyone ever doing a jump lead.
But we do know that Brian Roberts was not some 80 runner, and he was Mike's son, and he came to the major leagues fully formed as an amazing base runner and aggressive base stealer. So Mike is very good at coaching this.
And the thing that jumps out, though, is that what you're right, it is instinctual, but at the same time, what you coach when you're coaching base running is to also make it intellectual, and that's hard to do.
It's very difficult
But that's like, I will tell you right now, if Brian Roberts, because to me you just summed it up, a healthy Brian Roberts in the prime of his career reaches against John Lester
and he's on third base,
he's on third base every single time, because he's one of those few guys who actually can surmount the muscle memory, I'm too far out.
Right.
He would start out at 12, and then 20, and then 25, and by the time
Lindor might be then by the next start. Right. He might be. We'll see.
And by the time Lester goes in, because you know that once he starts to go in his move, you are trusting. He's not throwing over. And so the other thing with that is yes, he's quick to the plate, but you're not waiting for a read. You're basically...
just go. Forget you're just, the read.
So
just go.
You put all that together, but it is very difficult to do. Because you're right, this is not something where you normally practice against guys where you say the throwing to first base is out of the question, except for a back pick from the catcher after the pitch.
That's what they have to guard about.
That's the thing is that you have to go, on this pitch, I'm going. Right. And if I get thrown out, I get thrown out. But you know what? There's no part of me trying to get back in time for the back pick.
But that is the part of it that I don't think is factored in. Is the back pick, you have to totally have the mentality of selling out that you're going. And the back pick is what David Ross has done for years. That's one of the reasons he's Lester's personal catcher.
I do wonder what's going to happen next year.
Right, it's going to be a challenge. Wilson Contreras is not afraid to back pick.
Right.
But he's going to have to, hopefully, for the Cubs' sake and for John Lester's sake, he's learned some of these tricks and some of how to handle them, because John Lester's not easy to handle.
John Lester did, by the way, field a ball, a comebacker,
and he underhanded it. No, he just bounced it.
He underhanded it.
Kick save,
and then underhanded it.
Then there was also the swing bump where he didn't even try and get off the mound.
Yeah, he just looked at it.
You can at least make the effort.
Jose Ramirez, with the Ruthian blast that went about 25 feet, but it was perfect.
It's what we say, it's a line drive in the box score.
I mean, it is crazy. This game last night, now you do have the Roberto, it ends up going, Roberto Perez hits two home runs, and so it gets
out. I do want to talk about it as soon as we segue into that.
But it was 2-0 because of a swinging bunt that went 25 feet and Brandon Guyer doing what Brandon Guyer does, which I don't want to spend much time on this, but I do love in that game last night. You want to talk about profile? Brandon Guyer, okay, who's less profile in a corner outfield spot? Brandon Guyer or Chris Coughlin?
Chris Coughlin.
Yeah.
For sure. I mean, Brandon Guyer does his one job very well. He gets on base and hits with decent gap power against left-handed pitchers. That's his job. He does it very well. He's a capable defender. Chris Coughlin right now just looking, I don't know if I'd say lost, but just not, his job is to hit, and he hasn't been very comfortable in the box.
The thing with Guyer, too, is that's an 0-2 backdoor slider that off his back knee. I mean, he did, or not slider, but just a backdoor back knee pitch. And I think for him, that's not super easy to lay off of an 0-2 when you're protecting. I mean, that's a ball that he loves to take strikes.
But I was going to say this. Brandon Guyer has a built-in radar that goes doop, doop. doop, 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 doop. Hey, this may hit me.
And that's what it is. But, I mean, you're right. And I think that's one of those things. You know, you look at Lester last night. He didn't pitch terribly. But, you know, he had one first inning where you walk two guys and hit batter and, you know, spirals out a little bit. And then you make one bad pitch four innings later to Roberto Perez. And that's all it took.
So we tee you up. Roberto, anyone in the world can send me a message that from before 8 o'clock last night that says, I predict that Roberto Perez will be the offensive star tonight. Kudos to you.
Beyond not just the offensive star, yes, it's easier when you have Kluber, Miller, Allen, but the catcher is still the guy in command back there. He guided a 6-hit shutout, 15 strikeout performance behind the plate against an excellent, dangerous offense. Then went up to the plate, hit two bombs, including one that was a separate, because it was 2-0 Indians and Lester's still dealing a little bit. There's a sense of, okay, this Cubs lineup can still get here. When he hits that solo bomb, make it 3-0, you start feeling a little more comfortable.
And then when he
ends it, I mean, this guy, forget just the offense, he had a fantastic all-around game. What do you want your catcher to do? Guide him through, guide your pitchers, make sure everything is framed perfectly, which he did. And then, oh, by the way, go ahead and give us some great pop.
And again, you talk about on the prospect side, the two, to me, you know, pitchers are the toughest because pitchers get hurt and pitchers can add a new pitch and all of a sudden be an entirely different person than they were literally 2 weeks ago.
Right, right.
But catchers, I mean, now this was Roberto Perez beyond how good Roberto Perez can be. And I say that. Yeah. Offensively.
159? Was that what his season average was?
I don't think it was that bad.
But
I'm pretty sure it was something.
He had three homers, though.
Right.
Yeah,
right,
three homers.
He had three homers, and now he had two last night.
And now three in the postseason.
And keep in mind, this was never a guy anyone thought would be starting a World Series game when you have Yan Gomes, and also they try to get Jonathan Lucroy when Gomes goes down. I mean,
the crazy thing is they've had Perez has been their catcher. I mean, has Gomes even gotten into a game yet in the postseason?
I don't even think of him. You guys kept on mentioning him in the last podcast. He's just like out of sight, out of mind. Roberto Perez is their catcher.
But I'm saying,
right.
I mean, he's literally on the roster. I don't even think he's played yet.
I don't believe he has, because why would he play? Roberto Perez has the pitchers doing exactly what he wants to do. I tweeted the kudos to, I mean, like a signing scout, Mike Soper, been with the Indians for a long time, more than a decade. Used to work for the Cubs. My Mike Soper business card that I got more than a dozen years ago says Chicago Cubs on it. It's pretty funny. So Soper has, I'm sure, I mean, we know he tweeted about it last night, but Roberto Perez, 22nd round pick of his. And don't forget, this guy had Bell's palsy in 2013. So part of his face was like paralyzed by this nerve condition. Couldn't close his eyes for months. I'm reading the old work report that where current Blue Jays GM Ross Atkins was quoted. Couldn't sleep, had to wear an eye patch at night. I mean, like, what's the deal with him and Mike Napoli, these non-sleepers? That's the new money ball. That's the new underrepresented, the market inefficiency. Find players who can't sleep, figure out how they sleep, and fix them up.
You go back to
33rd round pick, I'm sorry, Lake City, Florida Junior College. That's a great scouting story, and kudos to the Indians. They have a few of those on the team.
You know, you mentioned talking about catchers and what you look for, and there's no doubt it's incredibly tricky. And again, you know, you guys have been doing this longer, probably since before I was born, so I do defer. But
hey, come on.
Not quite, but close. You guys started in the 90s.
What was your birthday?
Well, I was born in 88, so, okay, so you good. Guys...
You're, I started you're, in the 90s.
I was working covering baseball, but not covering minors.
Okay, but I mean, you know, for me, when I look at catchers, and I think sometimes we get so caught up in, I don't know, some of the minutiae, and for me it's like, look, do you handle your pitchers well, and can you provide some pop? Because if you can do those two things, you have a future. I mean, we can talk all we want about, well, is his pop time 1.8 versus 1.9? Is his footwork not 100% optimal? But can you frame pitch as well? And can you hit the ball a long way and in spurts? Because if you hit 220, but you can provide 15 bombs and great defense, you have a future in the major leagues as a catcher. And at the end of the day, when we're talking about prospecting and looking for, but you can have all the ceiling in the world, but you have to be able to tap into it
Perez,
to be a big leaguer.
And Roberto Perez, best defensive catcher in the Indian system from 2010, 2011, 2012, best defensive catcher in the Eastern League in 2012. So he has lived up to the expectations that were on him throughout his career as an amateur and as a professional. And he was drafted out of high school by the Dodgers in 2006. So this guy, we do have
what were his
history
power numbers
on him
in the minors.
Well, he hit 22 home runs in his minor league career. So in 2014, when he got to the big leagues for the first time, that was his best offensive season. And again, that's when he got over the Bell's palsy.
Sometimes 305 catcher right. offense develops that, later.
But he is definitely a guy who was there for the catch and throw skills. That's what got him. A lot of scouts call him survival tools. He had the survival tools, the catch and throw, bilingual, able to handle a pitching staff, all these intangibles that he does bring to the table. And then last night, smart enough hitter to sit on a couple of pitches and square them up.
But
it was really cool to see for him.
The crazy thing with that is last night, literally, he already has done enough to what he's done even in the postseason to kind of ensure gainful employment, if healthy, for the next several years. But last night essentially locks up that minor league invite to spring training as a 36-year-old if he needs it. I mean, it's like you demonstrate stuff like that as a catcher, and the margin of backup catcher to catcher in AAA, it's a big difference. And Roberto Perez, I mean, has played his way into Yan Gomes will still be their guy next year, a healthy Yan Gomes. But
Perez will get 50. He'll get in 50 games easy.
He's gonna have he will get more time because as you said too, how he's worked with this pitching staff is something that again
it's
that
special.
Was a,
it's downright special.
Well, now we got Bauer against Arrieta. One of my favorite storylines that we hadn't talked about yet in this World Series, the heart high. It all comes back to Hart High 2011, Bauer and Mike Montgomery, the Rasheed Wallace of the Hart High basketball team, kicked off the team for too many technical fouls.
Yes. So let me ask you, though.
They have great cornrows. That's the real. It can't be Rasheed without cornrows.
Well, all I can say is bald online.
But bigger, I don't want to say feud, but less chummy teammate relationship. Trevor Bauer, Mike Montgomery, Trevor Bauer, Gerrit Cole.
That's a tough call. I think I'm going to say push.
I'm going to say push. Montgomery.
Montgomery's a little bit more of a hothead than Gerrit Cole. Although Gerrit Cole had the same reputation. Was he at Orange Lutheran?
He had
the same reputation. He's at Orange Lutheran. He was like ornery and bad makeup.
I've gotten to know him. He's just intense, but I wouldn't call him ornery.
But he definitely had that reputation in high school. There is no question.
I
agree with you, but I can tell you.
To me, Lackey's ornery. Cole's just intense. That's what he is now.
In high school, the scouts were like, bad teammate. I mean, that was out there consistently about Gerrit Cole. I don't think it was fair necessarily, and I think he grew out of it somewhat. I think he channeled that intensity in a more positive way. But he had the reputation of being a bad teammate, and he was focused on relentlessly because he was one of only two high school pitchers drafted in the first round of that draft. So he was Boris Klein out of high school. People honed in on the makeup. So we got a lot of reports on that.
I would argue.
Montgomery getting kicked off the basketball team is pretty bad.
But no. The other thing I'm going to say is remember, Trevor Bauer basically decided, and Montgomery was a year older than him, but Trevor Bauer decided, you know what? I'm not doing this senior year thing here. I'd rather get gone, than that. So I would say that piece of evidence right there does lead to some to say that his heart high experience was more ornery than
the common thread here is Trevor Bauer. he's a different cat, and we all know that.
Heart high, also James Shields.
That's right, absolutely. That's pretty good program.
Yeah, up in Newhall.
Arrieta struggled last year in the cold. Everyone's talked about that. I mean, like he's
and today is the last time it's going to be significant, really cold. It looks like if the weather forecast holds up.
I was looking in Chicago as I'm getting ready to pack and seeing what I need.
Lows in the 50s,
For my Southern California bones, that's very cold. I was worried it would be like 39, 42.
No, I mean,
it's 58 to 65. That's doable.
We know Arrieta doesn't like to wear sleeves. I mean, we all saw him in the body issue. We all saw too much of him in the body issue. But this guy's, he's going to have to, Jake Arrieta's got a lot riding. And this is not last year's Jake Arrieta. Bottom line, he hasn't been great this year. He's been erratic. He's had issues with command and... he doesn't hold runners well, as Bad Eddie said the other day. So, I don't know. Is it a must-win game for the Cubs, guys?
It's not must-win, but the same... Because I do think that... I tweeted this as soon as the game was over last night, and they talked about it in the broadcast. I mean, it's a pretty obvious point. But that game was much more vital last night for the Indians, who really only have... I mean, it is in Corey Kluber we trust as far as the starting pitching than it is for the Cubs. So... Even if the Cubs lost this game tonight, I think it's vital for them to win it. But if they lose this one,
they go home for three.
They go home for three.
They're not.
And they're going to have the starting pitching advantage in three of the remaining five. And you could argue, okay, you're not going to have it if it's Kluber. You know, when Kluber starts, maybe. But if you've got Kluber going on short rest, maybe that ends up kind of negating some of that. And credit to the Indians to do it. It's not like Andrew Miller's not going to throw tonight because he went 46 last night. But it does mean you're not going to – you don't have to worry that you're going to see Andrew Miller from the fifth through the – you know, to turn it over to the eighth, probably.
I think you're going to see him. I think you're going to see him, and I think he will be used as aggressively as if he had not pitched in game one.
I don't disagree with you. I do think, though, the Cubs, who put together about as good an ABs – they put together better ABs against Andrew Miller last night than the Blue Jays ever dreamed of doing.
They still didn't get him.
But they did at least – they did that last night.
They made it interesting. They loaded the bases, a more victory against Andrew Miller.
Yeah.
If Miller is a little less tonight, which is possible because he threw 46.
Right.
If he's a little less, that means that, okay, so he's only near immortal. He's not immortal. That, again, you have these situations where you say, no, this is a game that shapes up pretty well. We don't know what we're going to get from Trevor Bauer. I mean, we do not know that Trevor Bauer is not going to be bleeding all over the ball in the first inning.
Exactly. I just hope we don't have a bleeding out.
That's my whole thing. And I mean, we
bleeding out of his whatever, use the current vernacular. Sorry.
Can't believe had to go there. That's the other thing here. I mean, obviously, there's a little bit of a laughing, jokeable, he could have thrown a drone. Will he bleed out? But, I mean... you know, it's serious. If you have to go and use your bullpen for, eight innings again, maybe, especially for a team that already has a, mysterious game four starter, probably will be Kluber on short rest. But, I mean, this is not an exception. They have a very good bullpen, and they've gotten a lot of stand-up pitching performances. Mm-hmm. But even with that, you really don't want to stretch it where, okay, you're going to have to give us eight innings tonight, and then... I don't think anyone expects Josh Tomlin to give you, eight scoreless in game three. I mean, you're probably going to need at least three or four of those guys again
in
game three.
If you get five out of Josh Tomlin, you're popping champagne.
If you get four, you go, good job, Josh.
So, I mean, it's something where I think the Indians could really, really, really benefit, even if Bauer just gives them five innings. You know, just don't have that same issue where, oh, crap, he's done after two-thirds, he won't stop.
Right.
Okay. That could actually be problematic for how the rest of the series lines up.
I know you said mystery, who's going to start game four. Okay, I'll start with you,
I'm
John.
Just saying, technically, it's TBD. Technically.
What are the – give me the percentage chance.
Game four.
I was going to say 99.
I agree. I'm just saying, technically, officially, it's TBD.
I don't think there's any way you take him out last night with a three-run lead after one batter, even with Schwarber up. There's just no way that you take him out because he's been so effective against everybody. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm underestimating the data third time through a lineup, that kind of thing.
But the other part of that
Kluber's a little less an issue with that when you look at his complete game and shutout streak. I mean,
still think I'm probably underestimating that because Andrew Miller. That's why you would use if you're going to use Andrew Miller at all in the seventh inning, you use him to face Schwarber. You want him facing their best left-hand hitter, and that's what they did. But
what I was going to say though is the one thing with Kluber, if he does go short, they did a good job of spelling this out. Look at how many innings Kluber has thrown. Look at how many pitches Kluber has thrown in October. He is as much as he's been vital for them. This is actually not a heavy workload from this month. It's actually a light workload because they've actually wrapped up some series and all.
Yeah,
he's had a whole lot of rest.
In the last 2 years, he threw 236 innings and 222, and he was 215 in the regular season this year. So, and he's a horse. I mean, he's always been a true number one.
He's been durable. Like even our 2010 scouting report, basically, he talks about one of the things we kept talking about over and over. Yeah, he had an injury in high school. He had a stress fracture. He had a screw in his elbow and all that. But durability is something that Corey Kluber always had.
Yeah. No. He. He was outstanding last night, so at the end of a long season, Corey Kluber is still very good. We'll see what we get out of Trevor Bauer and Jake Arrieta tonight. Longer podcast this morning, time to wrap it up, but we'll be back at it again tomorrow, day off, but we'll break down game two, look ahead to the rest of the World Series. Kyle's headed to Chicago to see some history. Lucky for you.
And do remember, everyone, this game starts an hour earlier than scheduled tonight because they moved it up because of the rain. Yay! Yeah,
my son is excited about it, and I think he's going to get disappointed and get a rainout. So I just remember from our winter meetings gala last year where Bud Selig talked about his passion for watching the weather and the radar and all that kind of stuff. I don't think Rob Manfred shares it, so he'll probably leave it to the weather folks instead of the commissioner in a trench coat being right there.
There's a window here coming open.
That apparently was one of Bud Selig's passions. So another way that we've changed in the front office of Major League Baseball. So great stuff, guys. Thanks for all your time this morning. Thank you for the downloads here at BaseballAmerica.com or at iTunes. For Kyle and JJ, I'm John. We'll see you next time. So long, everybody.
This concludes our program. Want more in-depth baseball coverage? Be a better fan. Visit BaseballAmerica.com to get more comprehensive baseball coverage.